Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. We are here again to discuss Nancy Guthrie. She was taken out of her home in the middle of the night. I call it the witching hour on February 1st of this year. She has still not been found. No arrests have been made. And it's just one of these cases that is taking forever. And it's just so very sad. She was 84 years old, the mother of Savannah Guthrie. We have an incredible guest tonight. He's not only a guest, but he's truly a friend of the show, friend of mine, proud to call him a friend, and somebody who I love to have on for their legal mind. He's somebody who did the job for decades, both as a prosecutor and forever as a defense attorney. And everyone knows I might be at the opposite end of the defense attorneys most of the time, but I have the utmost respect for the good ones. So please help me welcome to the stage, Philip Dubé.
How are you, Jennifer? Look at you. You don't look a day over 19. Look at her.
Gosh.
You look great.
Can you please put your glasses on? I know normally you wear glasses.
Sure, no problem.
No, I meant because then you'll see me more clear.
I can see you. Are you kidding? I said earlier, I don't know what the hell you eat, but you look terrific. I'm serious. So
well, you do too, Philip.
Bless you.
So listen, we've got a little bit of a menu here that we're going to go through specifically to talk about what I am calling the biggest issues with the case that happened really from early on. We're going to go through them very tactically, one by one. And I want to get your take from a lawyer's view. I just saw my good friend Mark Garagos on a show saying this was a petri dish for the defense. And I want to see if you concur with that, don't concur with that, how harsh you would be on some things, what you've seen in other cases and what happened. So let's start with the fact that initially the case was not seen as any sort of crime, but was treated as a search and rescue. I want to quickly play the first little part of this clip and talk to you about it on the other side. Let me put my glasses on.
There you go. Got a meeting with all of you. Came to our attention. We got a call, a 911 call.
Give me 1 second. I want to get him up on the stage. Let me get this off the stage and put him on the stage.
Ms. Guthrie was reported missing from her home.
Okay, you ready?
We're here. Search and rescue mission, we hope. But we're looking for a missing person. Nancy Guthrie, I think we sent out an email to all of you. Came to our attention, we got a call, a 911 call, that Ms. Guthrie was reported missing from her home. That call came in around noon earlier today. Our teams came out, our search and rescue team, being supported by our volunteers are at the Search and Rescue Association.
All right, you get the gist of it. This by this time, this is very late at night that he's broadcasting, and he's saying, listen, this was a search and rescue mission. We had our folks out. Do you think that causes any problem that that's how initially they thought this case was the reason that Nancy was missing, basically a walk away?
Well, at that point, I don't think so. No harm, no foul at that point, because let's face it, the sheriff of Pima County is accountable to the body politic there in the jurisdiction. And Nancy Guthrie is or was, God forbid, the mother of a famous television media personality. And people want answers. People want to know what their tax dollars are going toward. What efforts are they making to try to find this senior citizen whose beloved daughter is a national icon on daytime television? So no, at that point, I don't think mistakes were made. Having said that, I still think the sheriff as a law enforcement official has to be cautious about what is being revealed, because you don't want the perpetrator to have a false sense of mission accomplished. You don't want that individual or individuals to think that they pulled off the perfect crime. So you want to kind of keep things close to the vest, not reveal too much, and not rush to judgment. Because if you really think about it, by relegating it under the rubric of a walkaway, as opposed to an abduction at that point, prematurely rules out kidnap and abduction. It minimizes any criminal activity at that point, or how you would characterize the crime. And if at a later point they determine that something greater happened, such as a kidnap, such as a homicide, they have to walk back on the initial statement that they gave. And it makes them look, I don't know, I don't want to say foolish, but it makes it look like they in fact rushed to judgment and they should have held off addressing the media.
So basically, you kind of agree that this was a little bit premature to come out to the media to make this statement, but you still think no harm, no foul.
I think no harm, no foul. I think to the extent that he's addressing the public, the body politic, the electorate, the people who installed him into that office to let them know what, if anything, is being done, I think he is in some sense accountable to the people. Now, having said that, I don't think he needs to divulge every detail, every task, every deed that's being done to try to get to the bottom of it, because you don't want to give away your tactics, your strategy, and certainly what you know. Because depending on how much you give to the press, you never know. These abductors could be hip to that intel, start destroying evidence, and maybe even harming third parties who could provide additional information. But if you leave it vague as just a walk away, you know, we're working on it, we don't know what, if anything, happened, it doesn't look like anybody else is in jeopardy or facing potential harm at that point.
Right. So, of course, and you touched on this, that initially treated it as a search and rescue mission. And then, of course, now we see the FBI just coming out a couple of days ago saying they're investigating it as a kidnap for ransom. But I kind of agree with you, Philip, that early in the investigation, he was just trying to calm the masses.
Yes.
Right. In this. And so, you know, maybe him saying that, listen, we're out here on a search and rescue, we have volunteers, blah, 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 wasn't that detrimental. I want to next talk to you about, though, something that's really been talked about. Again, short clip. We'll talk about it on the other side. This has to do with the release of the crime scene. They searched beginning on February 1st. There's a lot of questions about whether they were there a few hours or whether they were there many hours searching, but nevertheless, he certainly had it released by the next morning of February 2nd. This is what he had to say. Take a listen.
One of the things people...
after Monday's investigation and really opening access to that property to everyone else, was that something you would do differently looking back, knowing that, you know, federal authorities also conducted a search yesterday? Would you have kept that perimeter up knowing that?
You know, Monday morning quarterback, I probably would have, but I'll say this. We processed the scene. We got what we thought was complete. My team did that. I have to have all the faith and trust in their abilities and their skills, and I think they went through that pretty well. But because another agency now steps in and wants to assist, we're just like with you, we're an open book.
So what do you think about this? He sort of walks back, you know, that, yeah, Monday morning quarterback, I left it open too soon. And yeah, this other agency wants to come in. And basically, I took that as that's why it's making us look bad, because they want to come in and do their own work on top of ours. What do you think about the release? We'll talk first about the release of the crime scene. Do you think that's a problem? And have you seen that in any other cases?
Yes and no. He's put 100% confidence in the people who work in the crime lab, the forensic technicians, the analysts, everybody who goes out to the scene to collect and process the evidence. He was convinced that they did their job to the full extent. Having said that, there are times when you need to leave a scene like this sealed. Do not just open it up, unseal it, because for all we know, very valuable trace evidence could have been overlooked. Biological evidence, footprints, shoe prints, maybe even fingerprints that were left behind on some type of surface, various types of biometrics that could have been available. For example, coming through the door, some type of measurements, if any, could be at risk, spatial relations, furniture, personal effects that were in the property, anything that gets moved or otherwise disturbed could really compromise the integrity of the scene, and it's permanently lost. Remember, there are certain things that just cannot be recaptured once it's contaminated, because then it's going to be fodder for the defense if and when somebody is apprehended, right? So now, in theory, when you've unsealed it, any third party can just come through, track other evidence throughout the house, just traipse and transfer maybe even an innocent person's biological evidence through the house. Think about everywhere we've walked in life, Jennifer. Everywhere our shoes meet the concrete, the sidewalk, the street. Imagine how many other people's biological evidence or even botanical evidence our own feet and shoes are picking up. And then to walk into an unsealed crime scene now that in theory should have been left sealed so they could go back a little more meticulously to collect the evidence, but now it is forever contaminated. Now, I'm not going to say it's inexcusable. It's just that he put 100% faith in his staff. And I think he really did overlook the possibility, perhaps, of trace evidence, microscopic evidence, fibers, dirt, hair, anything, even what we call slough off. Sometimes they call it desquamation. People's skin cells just dry up, they slough off, they can be left behind at a crime scene from dirty, oily skin, diseased skin, from, let's say, eczema, psoriasis, or even a sunburn for that matter. Eczema could just drop off onto the floor, and it wasn't all collected. And if and when you get a suspect, you could have compared all that desquamation in evidence to the suspect, but now it's all gone, or it's tainted forever. And that just cannot be undone at this point. It cannot.
So when you see something like this, and to me, to your point, the Bureau, who I have to say, and there's amazing things about the FBI, and there's some things that aren't the best about the FBI, but the thing that they do best, no matter what expert I have on, no matter who I speak with, obviously I'm biased, but I'm talking about people that aren't with the FBI, they will all tell you the number one crime scene evaluators, collectors, evidence control technicians are FBI agents. And that's what they do. That's what they are extremely good at. And the FBI wanted to come back in. Philip, you're not going to believe when they went back in. They went back in finally on day four. And this brings me to my next question. So on day four, they go in for search number two. Then on day six, they go in for search number three, which you see right here. This wasn't a small time search. They had forgotten to collect these cameras on the rooftop. And of course, they were doing some other things, as we can see, notes being taken and such. Then on day 12, agents and officers, and I think it was mostly officers, went back and said, oh, geez, I forgot to check the septic. So now you have the Pima County there one day, and then you have the FBI there on day four. And then, like I said, the rooftop search on day six, the septic tank they think about on day 12. And then there was a lot of milling around. This is after day 12. This is Nancy's property. They're still milling around there looking. Talk to me about what four searches mean. Do you think as a defense attorney, you can kick out everything after search one and say it's corrupted?
It depends. But let me tell you, I'd be frothing at the mouth if this was my case. And I'll tell you why. There is no such thing as a murder exception to the warrant requirement, meaning that just because you suspect that maybe there was a killing at a crime scene doesn't mean you just get to go in there without a warrant. You have got to get a search warrant under certain circumstances. Search, just for watchers and listeners, doesn't necessarily mean a rummaging. Search is a legal term of art. It can also mean just an entry. You cross the threshold of private property as law enforcement, that is considered a search once you enter the property. So the question now becomes, what was the scope of any warrant? If the scope is limited as to what you're allowed to look for, gather, and collect, and you go in there a second and third time, maybe perhaps without a warrant, not only are you conducting a warrantless search, but the subsequent searches could exceed the scope that was allowed under the first warrant. And what does that get the defense? Suppression of all the evidence. You get it all thrown out. How would this come up? Well, as a practical matter, most defendants do not have standing to contest a search or seizure by law enforcement unless it was of their person, of their own dwelling place, or if they were a social guest or an overnight guest somewhere. So let's suppose Nancy had a guest that she allowed in, gave consent in, hey, it's great to see you. Could have even been a gardener for all we know, but gave that individual permission to come in. That person now has standing, if and when arrested and charged with murder, to suppress any evidence collected on the second, third, or fourth search that was outside the scope of the first warrant, and that was not even warranted the second, third, and fourth time. So you put the entire investigation at risk. And you can thank the U.S. Supreme Court for this. Back in 1990, they handed down Minnesota versus Olson. And that was the Byron White court, by the way. He was appointed by JFK, I think it was in 61 or 62, who basically held that if you have a guest in your home, they have the right to contest a search or a seizure, even though it's not their property. Even if they don't have a lease, if they're invited in there for a social purpose and the cops are involved and they go in there without a warrant or a consent or an exception to the warrant requirement, start patting it down, looking around and finding evidence in your room there, it's all getting thrown out, all of it, if they don't have a warrant. And that's what this law enforcement team did in this case when they went back a second, third, or fourth time. Never mind the first time. If the first time they didn't have a warrant and the suspect, like I said, was a social guest or an overnight guest, all that evidence is going bye-bye.
So let me ask this, because you do bring up a very interesting point. My understanding is, in this case, I could not believe that they wouldn't get a warrant on the first search. I just couldn't believe if that's the case. And even on the second search with the FBI, being an agent, knowing no matter what, I got a warrant, even if I had consent. Because especially early on in the investigation, what if somebody gives me consent that later becomes a subject? It's a hot mess.
Yes,
you just have to get it. You have to get warrants. And when you leave, this is in my experience, you cannot go back. You can't do it without a warrant. You can do it with a warrant, but then you're literally looking like an idiot before the judge when you say, we forgot to search the roof. Oh, now you want to violate Fourth Amendment rights again? Or not again, but you want to go up there and intercede on those rights when you're... You know, you not remembering to search the roof and the septic and go back. It's a little bit different when the locals went and then the Bureau went. It was the third and fourth search to me. But we don't know if they got warrants. I'll tell you what I understood, at least the media reported. And again, it's always source reporting, so we don't really know. But is that it was consent search by the family. I see that as a huge problem, in my opinion.
Of course it is. They don't own the property. They don't have standing or authority to consent. They might want to, and in their mind, they might think they do, but the real test is, do they actually have authority to consent to a search of property that they don't own or possess? It's ridiculous. Now, having said that, if there was knowledge that Nancy Guthrie was deceased at the time of the search, and the family then inherited that property collectively, then yes, by operation of law, they own that property. Even though they might not physically have the deed in hand or a probate court didn't order title transferred, but if a trust says that, you know, Nancy and the other kids get an equal share of the house, then they all have authority to consent to a search of it. But that's only if Nancy is in fact deceased. If she's alive, it's not as if you can use a power of attorney to confer Fourth Amendment consent to search a property. That's not what a power of attorney is for. That's to help you pay your bills, go marketing, maybe get permission to have procedures done at the doctor's office, that type of stuff, but nothing in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, this is one point that has really bothered me from the beginning, and I talked a lot about it, about how I could only think of one time in my career ever that I begged my boss to go back. And I honestly, it's just been too long ago. Yeah. I just remember being, you know, feeling sick about it. And I remember getting bawled out, which I got bawled out a lot, especially early in my career, with the man who taught me everything I came to know pretty much in the Bureau. But it just doesn't happen. And you have to get a warrant. You cannot go back in. And I don't think that any of them, Savannah, Annie, Tommaso, Cameron, I don't think any of them, this is on, look, the first search is day one, Pima County. The second search is day four, FBI. The next search, day six, which you're seeing right here. And then the final search is day 12. And then, of course, there's all kinds of searches, like I said, people on her property. And I don't care if you're on the property. You can't be on the property searching either.
Of course. But so, again, it's only going to be an issue if somebody is arrested and has standing. In other words, a Fourth Amendment privacy interest in the property to challenge the search. If it's just some intruder, they don't have standing. But if it is somebody that Nancy knew, invited in, maybe even to stay the night, even a few hours, and it all went down during that brief encounter, they have standing. Now, there is another exception in the law where it's called an exception to the social guest rule, where if you're there just to commit a crime, sometimes they call it the hasty bailment doctrine. Like you're just there to do a drug deal, a drug drop off, or there to go pick up your drugs, that kind of thing. You're only going to be there a few minutes or an hour. Then you're not really a social guest, and you don't have Fourth Amendment standing because you don't really have that type of privacy interest in the property that an overnight guest might have who's dutifully and properly invited in for a lawful purpose. But assuming that she invited that person in and they were there long enough to hold themselves out as a guest, they would have standing. But if they're just an intruder, just an abductor, then it doesn't matter that the cops didn't get a first, second, third, or even a fourth warrant.
Okay, but wait a minute, Phil.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
So with what you're saying then, basically, which isn't the way the Bureau runs at all, because we run to the far right of the law.
Sure.
Right. I mean, even though, for instance, you have to have the person in custody and be questioning them, we read Miranda if we look at you sideways.
Yeah.
Right. Even though that isn't required by the law, it's just Bureau policy is way stricter than the law. But are you trying to tell me then that just say the third and fourth searches were done without a warrant, it's no big deal. If this kidnapper was not invited in previously.
That's correct. So it was not his property. If he had no rental agreement, he was not a social guest or an overnight guest. No, an intruder like that has no Fourth Amendment standing, period, constitutionally. Did I lose the hostess with the mostess? Uh-oh. Well, I'll keep doing the talking here until we recapture Jennifer. Yeah, folks, here's the bottom line. If you're going to commit a crime and you're going to do it in somebody else's home or property, A, don't talk to the police. And B, if the cops suspect that you are involved and they go into that property looking for evidence or trying to get a statement from you without a warrant before crossing that threshold, and you don't give them consent to enter even as a guest, that is an illegal search. And the remedy for an illegal search, an illegal entry into a property where evidence against an accused has been obtained is exclusion, suppression, the tossing of that evidence. And it will never, ever, ever, ever be heard by a jury or a finder of fact at a criminal trial. It cannot come into evidence. And if it does, it'll definitely be raised on appeal, and a higher court will reverse that lower court's finding, throw out the evidence, and remand it back for a new hearing. That's the law. Now, there is an exception, like I said earlier, and that is if you're going into a property just because you're up to no good, just momentarily, let's say, to do a drug deal, or maybe even let's say you're a prostitute and you're going in there just to give a homeowner a happy ending, let's say. And during that process, maybe there's a drug deal going on and you're only there for 20 minutes, then the court is going to deem you to be an actor as part of a hasty bailment. And the court will find that you do not have a Fourth Amendment privacy interest in the property so as to give you standing to challenge the search or seizure of anything that may have been obtained in the property. And now we have the lovely Jennifer Coffendoffer back. Okay.
I tell you, I just had a complete power crash. My computer just, it went black and then I had lines everywhere.
Yeah.
But the greatest thing was that you saved the day. I figured it was going to crash, but you were just, I came back on, you were just explaining things about the warrant. Isn't that interesting? So basically what you've said is it doesn't matter how these were done, but let me take it one step further. Let me take it and say this. Are you as an attorney going to at least try to argue this? And, or would you at least argue that whatever you got on the second, third, and fourth search is contaminated because everybody and their dog was in that house and could have planted it, could have left it, blah, blah.
Well, that would not be the subject of a Fourth Amendment search and seizure type motion. That would go to the weight of the evidence regarding scientific reliability. Should certain evidence even come in, just for its truth or substantively, never mind how it was collected by the police. That's a separate inquiry. But if, in fact, my client was just some unknown intruder who went in there just to exact revenge, or maybe even to abduct her for ransom, left behind enough identifying evidence to identify him and locate him and bring him in, he does not have standing to contest that search or seizure. Now, having said that, it is very possible that there is some case authority under state law in Arizona, not under the U.S. Constitution, federal precedent, but state law in the state of Arizona that, for all I know, might give an intruder like that Fourth Amendment standing. And I'll give you an example. Out here in California, which is shocking, if you steal a car, if you joyride a car and you're just driving along, minding your own business, and you're going up the interstate and the car has been reported stolen, you know, and the cops pull you over and they find something in the car, like a gun, stolen credit card, drugs, who knows what. A car thief in California under state law has standing to challenge the detention of that person and the vehicle. It's crazy, even though you're in a stolen car. But the car thief, him or herself, that person has standing to contest that search or seizure. If Arizona has a similar type case authority for it, then I would be derelict in my duty as a defense attorney not to raise it and to bring that motion. And let's just say it's unclear in the Arizona case law. It might still be incumbent upon me ethically, as long as what I'm doing is in furtherance of either modifying, extending, or reversing existing precedent under Arizona law. As long as I can make a good faith argument toward the extension, modification, or reversal of existing law, it is fair game. And you never know, you might get a courageous judge who will agree, grant the motion, and suppress all the evidence.
All right. I see what you're saying on that, but can you address the second question? And that is, how do the second, third, and fourth, how does that evidence even hold up when you've had other people in there, all these law enforcement, family, friends, people in and out? I shouldn't say friends, but we know Savannah said it was a zoo in there. You know, it was very hectic in there and all these law enforcement people. How can we even say that this evidence is credible when you come to search three?
It's up for a jury to decide. A jury would have to decide what and how much, if any, weight to put on that evidence. And that's why it's incumbent upon a thorough, scrappy criminal defense attorney to bring all that out and to show the jury that this wasn't collected the first time. It was collected the third time after an entire neighborhood, an entire police force had been traipsing in and out of that house. We don't know where their shoes, their gloves, their hands, and everything else has been prior to that. It's like I said earlier, when you touch a counter in public somewhere, or when you walk down a sidewalk, our hands and our feet are collecting and gathering a treasure trove of trace evidence, biological evidence that you don't even know you have. And before you know it, you walk into a crime scene and you're transferring it everywhere. And is it really fair to blame an individual who leads an otherwise law-abiding life based on evidence that was found on a floor that got transferred in from a cop's dirty shoe sole? I don't think that's fair. Lord only knows what's on the tread of a cop's shoe that he's bringing in from the elements. But the bottom line is, it goes to the weight of the evidence, not admissibility. And a jury decides if it's enough to convict.
How about something like this? I don't know if you remember this, but basically the CBP, the Border Patrol dogs, they got them in. This is very early at the very beginning when she was first reported missing. So this is from February 1st. And they used Nancy's blue shirt for the dogs to obtain a scent. They didn't have cadaver dogs. They had just scent dogs. And anyway, after they looked for Nancy for some amount of time, they took this shirt and just threw it on the rocks. This is in front of her house, instead of giving it to authorities. Or what I would have done was demanded that I call it 1A. It I would have taken as not exactly evidence, but certainly as a part of the case that I would want to collect and save as being used by the scent dogs. That's what I would have done. But they threw it on the rocks. I have no idea what happened after that. Do defense attorneys run with things like this? Just the sloppiness. Let's just call it the sloppiness of a case, how a case is handled.
Here's the bottom line. A judge is going to allow it in anyway. But it's going to be the defense attorney's job to show that the prosecution did not properly authenticate that evidence, meaning that they didn't show a proper chain of custody of that evidence. And if there is a break in the custody of that item, in the hands of law enforcement, to the tune of just leaving it out in the elements on some rocks without 24/7 monitoring of it to make sure that there was no movement of it, no handling of it in any other way, that to me, that evidence is worthless. It's compromise, because Lord only knows who, if anybody, could have come into contact with it, who could have tried it on for kicks and just laid it back down, or just picked it up thinking maybe it was a rag and put it back down. And meanwhile, you don't know where that person's hands have been, could have touched some surface out there that maybe an innocent third party touched. And before you know it, you have the transfer of DNA from some innocent dupe on a shirt. And then what happens? The dog picks up on that scent. And then later on, when they think they have a suspect, they hit on that scent and they think they've got a match. But the truth is, you've got transfer of contaminated DNA or trace material on a garment that belongs to an innocent person. And this is pretty scary stuff.
And I want to be clear, Philip, that this would not have been something that they would have needed as evidence. But I know what you're saying. You're saying it in general context. And I'm even broadening that question out more to say, hey, listen, if you're going to have a sloppy investigation, this is just one point I think I would make as a defense attorney. I would bring up a bunch of little bullets here, right? The crime scene not being secured, four searches being done. And by the way, even the scent shirt that they use, they just discard it on a rock, you know? And so I guess what I'm trying to say about this is just the overall handling. I guess that's something that you would you risk even kind of going down that road?
No, we saw, for example, what happened in the Karen Reed case. Remember when they were collecting all the evidence outside the house? They just used like a market brown paper bag and started using some Solo cups just to collect evidence. It was just shoddy and sloppy, and it was so unscientific. And to take a garment and just throw it out there on the rocks and to suggest that dogs could use that as evidence to hit on when trying to identify a scent, it just comes off as being amateurish and unscientific. So remember who the audience is going to be in the final analysis. It's not going to be a fellow peace officer. It's not going to be an FBI agent. It's not going to be another attorney. It's going to be a jury of 12 lay people looking at this. So they don't work in the system every day to understand how this thing really has value the way it should in a criminal investigation. They might look at this as being the object of something that was so sloppy that they could not in good conscience convict. So you just have to remember who your audience is. Now, if whoever is apprehended opts for a judge trial, a bench trial, judges are pretty much impervious to these types of mishaps and sloppiness, and I could see them getting convicted. A jury of 12, though, would look at this as a Heavens to Murgatroyd moment and think that the cops should do better and not convict on this type of evidence.
So to that point that you're making there, I want to talk about this. Now, let me show this that everybody's seen 100 times, but we're going to show it again anyway. Well, actually, I'll put this up. This mat, right? He has a bite light in his mouth. He's standing over the mat. Obviously, this is on the approach. This is after he's departed. We see all of the blood there, but I'm more concerned about this mat that wasn't taken. Talk to us about that. Is that another thing that you're looking at? I was thinking about it in this way, that if it wasn't properly processed, which you can do processing of a mat there, but every crime scene expert I've had on the show said they absolutely should have taken the mat. I think they should have taken the mat. But nevertheless, couldn't you just say, if I'm the defense attorney, I would say, you know who the perpetrator is. His DNA was all over the mat. Oh, but you guys didn't even take the mat. I would just be salivating over this mat. But maybe I'm wrong. What do you think about it? Would this be something you would point out as a defense attorney?
Of course I would. And by the way, it would be based on a famous case that came out of Arizona. I think it was in the 90s. It was called State versus Mark Bogan. Mr. Bogan was accused of a murder where a body was found under a Palo Verde tree. And his truck apparently had some type of scrape in the paint. I don't know. There was some type of paint transfer that was obviously inflicted on this truck, and the paint was missing. But in the bed of the truck, they found some pods and seeds from a Palo Verde tree. And they brought in from, I believe it was the University of Arizona, right there in Tucson, Dr. Timothy Helengaris, who is a geneticist. He's a forensic botanical expert who took the stand and testified that the pods, that the seeds that were recovered in the bed of that truck were unique to that specific tree where the body was found. And the only way that those seeds could have ever gotten onto the bed of that truck is for him to personally be there, and that jury convicted. What is my point? We don't know, for example, what type of shoes Porch Guy was wearing, what type of tread they had, what type of botanical DNA was lodged in the tread that he somehow left behind on that doormat. And what is a doormat for? It's to scrape all the waste and the dirt, foliage and debris from the bottom of your shoes so you don't traipse it in the house and you don't track it in the house. That would have been very valuable DNA, because let's say Porch Guy would have been apprehended and they go through his closet and they find some shoes. The shoes go to the lab and aha, there is botanical evidence in the tread that matches the doormat. And it's unique. It could only be that particular potted plant, that particular shrub, as opposed to the entire species that would have left that behind. But now that that mat is gone, you have forever foreclosed a matching opportunity. That was shoddy police work, in my opinion. And the irony of it is that the case came out of their jurisdiction, right there out of Tucson. So you would think that they would all be hip to that idea that botanical DNA, botanical material can be collected from just about every surface, including a doormat.
You know what? This is a perfect segue into my next question.
Okay.
This, as I said, everybody has seen that. He goes up to the door, blah, blah, blah. He turns and gets the I'll just call it foliage, vine, ivy, whatever exactly it is. He goes and gets it right here. And then what happens is, and I don't have the best picture up here, but what happens is right here. You can see it here, but I have a better picture. I just don't have it here of all this foliage. They left it. They left all that foliage that he used and he had up here in his hands. And he had that bite light in his mouth. So you can imagine spit on your hands going back and forth. And then, you know, that's on your gloves. And then you go and you grab that. All of that. I just cannot believe they didn't take the plant. And I have the pictures where you can see the whole plant, I think, is there. I don't think they took any of it.
Well, you know, plant forensics are very commonly linked to a suspect today. It's very common, especially rare plants. What if, hypothetically, like I said earlier, Porch Guy is apprehended? They search his dwelling or wherever he lives. Maybe, who knows, for all I know, maybe he's living in a car. And lo and behold, in the trunk of the car, they find those gloves. And the gloves go to the lab. And by the way, Dr. Tim Helengaris is still alive. I don't know if he's still teaching, but they could put him on the stand and say, I have analyzed the plant material found embedded in those gloves, and I have compared it to the foliage at that plant at the door, and it is a DNA match. But guess what? The plant was never collected. So what are you going to compare it to? It's not like there's a DNA data bank of plants, you know, to unsolved crimes. I mean, it's ridiculous. So to me, that was a lost opportunity to try to get additional evidence to nail Porch Guy. And that is lost for all time, unfortunately. And again, I find it a little ironic that Dr. Helengaris is out in that jurisdiction. You would think that they would get training on this topic to know better, that when you have plant DNA at your disposal like that, that you would collect it, store it, do whatever you can to have it available for if and when the time comes to charge Porch Guy.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing, is all of this becomes so important after you have the suspect. Sometimes it can lead to the suspect, but the big thing it's always used for is after you have your person, because then you're comparing all of this. Now, I want to point this out too and talk about another search that happened days later. Another search happened, as you might remember, when the tent messed up or went up. A tent went up in front of her front porch and they hid behind there, right? We know they did measurements because you could kind of see a little bit, right? They did measurements, try to figure out how tall porch guy was relative to the other items. And I think they got shoe size. If they didn't, they're idiots, but I'm sure they did, because you could tell exactly how big those sateel tiles were. But they put this all under a white tent. And when the white tent disappeared, this disappeared. This bracket, see that plant matter on there?
Yeah.
This bracket disappeared, and that is what held the Nest camera that was yanked off the wall and disconnected at 1:47 in the morning. This is my point. If there was something on that bracket, it was up there for weeks before they went back. I can't remember the exact day, but that might have been day 12. At least almost 2 weeks or more. I mean, I get what they could have gotten off of there for sure. Even the glove that was used, if he at all grabbed it, you can tell how forcefully he used that plant matter.
Yeah.
It wasn't just waving it like a lot of us. I thought it at the beginning, maybe he was waving it, try to obscure his face. No, he had that plant matter right in there grabbing, because look at it all secreted in the side. So they decide to take it. But again, Philip, I don't know how good of evidence that is once it's been there for many, many days, let's say.
Well, it depends on whether or not it could be linked to whoever abducted her. If it can be linked, if it can, and that particular item has always been in that position, then does it really matter? If an expert can take the stand and say with scientific certainty that specific plant matter, the DNA from it, matches the plant matter embedded in his gloves or in whatever garment he was wearing, then I think in the end it doesn't really matter, unless the defense is that he had prior dealings with Nancy Guthrie, that he had been there before, that maybe he did some gardening for her. He worked on the premises. He was a groundskeeper. Then that could be a defense. But if the individual had no connection to the property, I don't know. I still think it could sink him, even though from a time and space manner, it may have been a little too remote. I still think that a jury might put a lot of weight on it, just because, even though it wasn't collected immediately.
That's good to know. I mean, you know, these days watching all these trials, and you see the minor, what I would call pretty minor mistakes, yeah, that sort of overshadow,
yes,
the big amount of evidence, right?
Yes.
And that's what a defense attorney is meant to do. But normally I find jurors, unless they are predisposed based on, you know, nullification type issues, you know, mm-hmm, anger that they have about something else and they're making a point.
Yes.
Other than that, I found jurors to be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And they figure it out and they get it right. At least in my opinion, I've never had a bad jury, but I've seen them in this space, you know, in the true crime space now.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
I want to talk about next another thing that's also come up, and that is the big problem between the FBI and Pima County. Rumors about that, and then Kash Patel has come out 3 different times and said they didn't let us get involved. Let's listen to one and talk about it on the other side. This is with News Nation.
What's the update on that case? From day one, the FBI offered up our assistance because it was a state and local matter. So we were not the lead agency because it was not being investigated as a federal matter, because there was no evidence about a federal nexus to a federal crime. So we showed up immediately and offered our assistance. We were not let in for 4 days. And that's their choice. We continued to offer assistance. I even visited our Tucson office, where we had 150 agents and analysts working on the Nancy Guthrie case to provide intelligence. What the FBI is great at, what we did when we finally had access to the Ring doorbell camera, for example, we went to our partners at Google and we said, hey, we know that there wasn't a paid subscription service, but let's go look at the metadata and see if we can find a needle in a needle.
Okay, again, and he goes on a little bit, but the point of the matter is, he said now on three different occasions, he said it on a podcast, he said it to News Nation, and then he recently said it again just about a week ago in a presser about a gang case, not even related. Somebody, you know, gave a shot below the belt and said, yeah, but what's going on with Nancy Guthrie? And he again said, we weren't invited till day four, blah, 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 which I very much believe. But my question to you as a defense attorney, is this something you even bring up? Would you try to spar with that a little bit and get that allowed in? Would a judge even allow it in to show that there was a complete disarray amongst the partners and that that led to this case not being well done?
That would not be the reason why I would spar over it. I'll tell you what my tactic would be. And we saw this out here recently with the Palisades fire trial. That Jonathan Rinder connect. If you recall, Jonathan was accused of starting a fire in the Palisades area, the Santa Monica Mountains. And there was some dispute as to whether or not that terrain was federal land. Was it state or federal? Well, the bottom line was it turned out that that local jurisdiction here in California had a contract with the federal government for criminal jurisdiction. In other words, because of the type of terrain, the type of resources, and the type of manpower that would be needed, the jurisdiction basically surrendered by contract in exchange for funding criminal jurisdiction to the feds. So what does that mean? It means that the federal government took charge of that prosecution. The state of California did not try the case. And I'm beginning to believe that here there may have been a situation where some type of federal jurisdiction may have been conferred upon the FBI, federal law enforcement, by agreement, by contract, in exchange for funding for that area, maybe to keep up the mountains, to keep up the terrain, to preserve the wildlife and the animal kingdom. And if that's the case, then you've basically surrendered your rights to prosecute by contract. And I have a feeling that may have been the impetus behind the FBI even getting involved. The only thing that I could possibly think of as another reason why they would get involved is that Pima County did not have the resources to properly criminally profile who could have done this. Sometimes, as you know, in Quantico, Virginia, they have a criminal profiling program of FBI agents who are trained on how to profile and figure out who the individual would be. Would it be a single white male? Could it be an older female with no children? They can pretty much characterize and pigeonhole who the offender would be just based on how the crime scene presents to the eyes of the profilers. Those are the only two reasons why I would think that the feds would get involved. For profiling purposes or because of a contract for services for criminal jurisdiction?
Well, I can tell you this, just a couple of things, and that is the FBI always gets involved whenever they're asked because of resources, right? In other words, Pima County would never have the hundreds of analysts that would be needed to look at all the video, kind of just like in Idaho. The difference in this case was Idaho, the night they were found, there were agents involved. They opened up a case. There were 60 agents within just a day or two. In this case, it was 4 days before they were really allowed to come in with all their resources, their lab, their just everything the FBI can offer. And you can see as recent as last week, he is keeping himself as far away from this case as he can. Yeah. I still think that's because there are too many problems. And I think the FBI has a clear nexus to this case if they wanted it. And that's because under 18 U.S.C. 1201, it says that if you commit a kidnapping, essentially using interstate commerce, which would be Wi-Fi or any wires, if those two ransom notes, the first two that have been discussed, if those are proven to be valid and sent by the abductor, that is all the FBI would need. But Pima County wants this case, and the FBI doesn't. So, you know, that's why I think they're saying we'll continue to help. But nevertheless, you don't think that this is going to be any issue really that comes up, was all this squawking between these two during the procedure or proceedings later on?
Well, here's the thing. If it turns out that it really is the purview of the federal justice system by contract, it could be a motion to dismiss based on jurisdiction. If the Pima County Sheriff's Department and the DA's office does not have jurisdiction to prosecute the crime, that is grounds for a dismissal, okay? Now, it doesn't mean that the perp walks. It doesn't mean that they're off the hook. It just means that the case then gets filed by the proper prosecuting authorities. And in this case, it would be the federal government. And you can bet they would file. So it would just be a tactical move in the defense arsenal to get it dismissed, because you never know. Maybe the feds won't take it. Who knows? Maybe they don't have enough evidence. Maybe they don't feel it triggers enough of a federal interest for the feds to even get involved. I don't know. But the bottom line is, as a state defense attorney, if you can get your client dismissed on jurisdictional grounds, you've done your client a great service.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting to me. I also wanted to address a bias Bev's Cankles, not only because they have one of the best names of all the YouTube family, but this is a great question. And I know what I would do. Again, I've already said, but I want to hear from your perspective. The mat that we talked about, right, that I think would be possibly have some very interesting evidence on it, right? He stepped on it, the shoes, the spittle, blah, blah, blah. If they vacuumed it, which I think they probably did, or even treated it for DNA, right, with the solution to take the DNA, do you believe, or do you think you would have, as an attorney, would you bring up the fact that they didn't grab the mat? In other words, do you see that as a problem that, yeah, they have this, but that mat is still sitting over there at Nancy's house where it came from?
If they've collected all of the evidentiary value from the mat, including taking pictures of it, I don't know, using a vacuum to remove any trace matter, biological evidence, plant matter, anything whatsoever, and it is stored in evidence, the only thing that the defense is deprived of is their ability to test the mat themselves. But what they would be allowed to do is to test all the matter that has been recovered. So I don't see any judge excluding the results of any testing of that trace evidence found on the mat from evidence. The only time it's really going to be a problem for the defense is if any of it matches the clothing, the shoes, or possessions that the perpetrator has in their possession, either in their car, their home, or on their person. But if they don't have any of it, I don't even see how a judge would even let it into evidence, because it's not relevant. How do you tie it to a defendant on trial if there's no nexus? The mere presence of trace evidence without it being linked to an individual is writ large, if you will, irrelevant, per se irrelevant. I just don't see a judge allowing it in.
Yeah, what my issue would be is if I'm the defense attorney, I want that mat because I want to test it myself.
Yeah,
and the fact that they don't have that, that they did not collect this, I think is a big oversight, you know, one of the other oversights. I really do.
Well, you're familiar, you know, with the whole Trumbetta young blood doctrine, where federal officials or even state officials just dispose of evidence. They don't preserve it, if you will, keep it in the evidence locker or wherever they store it, unless you can show that it was done intentionally with some type of animus toward a defendant. There's no remedy. There really isn't. They don't have to store everything. Remember, the FBI, all these crime labs, even state and local, they don't have the capacity to store everything in perpetuity. I mean, in theory, this crime could go unsolved for 20 years. Between now and then, do you have any idea how much evidence from other cases is going to be collected and stored? You would need multiple warehouses to ultimately store all this. We cannot use taxpayer money to just store in perpetuity forensic evidence. At some point, there has to be a way to store and collect it or reduce it to some other state so it can be used at trial at a later time. So again, unless you can show some type of disdain or animus for a defendant, it's like a right without a remedy.
Wow, very interesting. I can tell you just off of that, how we handle it in the FBI, all this evidence. Once the case is adjudicated, and until it's adjudicated, we keep everything.
Yeah.
Just, I was just reading that in the Brian Koberger case, Idaho 4, they still have his car. Not the whole thing. It's like torn apart. But they still haven't gotten rid of that. I mean, and there's not even any appeals. I'm sure they're going to be getting rid of it. But they kept it throughout the whole case. And that's been my experience in the Bureau. You cannot get rid of evidence until you close the case, and you can't close the case until you get rid of evidence. So basically, at the end of the case, you have to either give it back. We literally will hunt down people and give it back, or give it back to the defense attorneys.
Yeah. Yeah.
We incinerate it with the agreement of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And other than that, I remember just having all these cases open, trying to get rid of this dang evidence. So to your point, you never, and I always say this, the Bureau, at least, we don't want to take evidence unless it is worthwhile. But this was worthwhile.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to move on to another question for you. And this has to do with all of the sources, all the sources that are out there. And I specifically want to talk about this source. And again, this, to me, I'm just going to say this again. This is not about the journalists. It's their job to get sources. It's about the sources. And there's one particular source that I had issue with.
You and mean I'm like, tip? Like a tip that's called in?
No, this individual works for Pima County.
I see.
He, Pima County detective, been there 20 years, but he hates the sheriff. I mean, a long list of people who hate the sheriff. But nevertheless, he hates him so much that he, in my opinion, disgraced his oath. And I'm just going to say that. I disgrace my oath if I am an FBI agent and I'm mad at my SAC and I go on television and talk to everybody and their dog about everything that went wrong in the case and try to provide insider information regarding how the case was handled, who was interviewed, what the agents think, what the law enforcement thinks from an insider perspective. Let me give you a quick soundbite. He was wrong on this and later retracted it and apologized. But anyway.
So see, what I heard was the opposite.
See, Brian called him out.
Okay, here. Again, it's hard to blame the searchers because the family was pretty insistent that this was a walk away as well.
So he comes out and says this, the family was insistent and everything hit the fan because that was actually the opposite of what the family had said. And Inton calls him out here, but this source was just a source for a while. And then he was behind a veil for a while. And then he finally just came out. My point is this, when you have somebody that is actually an insider, they're employed by the law enforcement agency, they're sworn to secrecy, if you will, we're not allowed to talk about ongoing cases, and you have them publicly going out and talking to everybody and their dog about different inside things, like this inside thing was, well, this is what the family thought, which ended up being wrong, and he later apologized. He said he misunderstood his source. right? He doesn't, he's not involved in the case, but he has people that are, that were apparently feeding him information. What is this something you point out, that all the leaking that was done in this case, because it is everywhere. I mean, it's just like Reuters. They recently leaked, supposedly, that the FBI told them that all the demand letters and notifications were hooey, were false. They didn't believe them. And then the FBI got so angry, they came out, and they've only come out three times in this case, and they said this: other ransom demands may potentially be legitimate and are still being investigated. In other words, don't tell us that we said that they're a bunch of BS, because we're not saying that, and that's not what we believe. Long-winded question, Philip. Help me out with this. What do you think about insiders that are giving information to the public that are sworn officers?
I hate glory hounds. I hate media-craving people. I do. This is a tough balance to strike between the right to freedom of speech and the right to preserve the integrity of an investigation. I think if that investigation is still in progress, it is still ongoing, and you are part of the investigative team, and you go public like that, I think there's an argument to be made that it is obstruction of justice. I actually think that it might be a criminal act. Now, whether or not it falls under federal, that's a different question, but I could see a state prosecutor going after somebody like that if it in fact impeded or interfered with a criminal investigation. I really could envision that. And for somebody with a law enforcement background who understands the classified nature of an investigation involving a missing person to go public with these types of diatribes and leaks of confidential detail, not only is it a breach of loyalty and a breach of oath to office, but I think it might actually be a criminal act.
You know, it's such an interesting point, because you're right. You wouldn't believe the distraction that all those, I mean, I don't know how many shows he was on. I never watched him. This was News Nation. That's why I know about it. Actually, that was Brian's, and it was sent to me specifically. Thank goodness I have a great team of people that keep my eyes open to a lot of this. But then I started researching. I couldn't believe he was just everywhere. Anyone that would have him on, he was on, bad-mouthing the investigation, bad-mouthing his, you know, department, bad-mouthing Sheriff Nanos. And it became such a, for weeks it was a distraction. And I guess that's how it could be looked at, obstructing justice, because it's obstructing the ability of law enforcement to go on, because they're dealing with that.
Exactly. And you would think that he would have talked to counsel or had the foresight to know that this could be a problem by going on the air and divulging some of this information. I think he was really ill-advised to have done it, or it was poor judgment on his part. Never mind costing him his badge or future employment. I could actually envision prosecutors coming after him if it meets the elements of some type of obstruction offense under Arizona law.
What about, because this is the counterpoint to that that somebody just brought up, what about the fact that you had Kash Patel not really giving any details about it, but basically saying we weren't invited to play in the sandbox? I see that as a big difference between something like what he said about, yeah, you know, they interviewed the family and the family thought this, and then all the other things he said, which were more confidential details.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about political sniping between state and federal. I mean, that's something that goes on every day. If you think about it, it's completely removed from the facts of the criminal investigation. He wasn't going into detail about what they've accomplished thus far, what they know, what they're willing to go public with. It was just really a battle of who's going to be at the helm of this investigation. And I think it's fair game. Remember what we're talking about here. You have a leader of a federal organization, and you have a leader of a county law enforcement agency, both of whom are accountable to the people. And the public has the right to know what's going on, how their tax dollars are being spent. And I think both leaders can answer those questions without compromising an investigation.
Great answer. I couldn't agree with you more that one was sort of political.
Yes.
You know, jarring, and the other one is much more refined to detail and specifically about that case. All right, Philip, I have kept you for an hour, and I want to be very understanding and respectful of your time. My last question is there anything I've forgotten? Is there anything in the Mark Garagos Petri dish, as he said, on this case that you would point out, Jen, you forgot this one, this is a mess, or you think we touched them all?
You know, I think there is an issue as to whether or not billboards should go up or flyers should go out to the public on this issue to help find Nancy or to help locate or identify the perpetrator. And I had mixed feelings about it. And then I thought about it even more and I realized, you know, this has actually been raised by the U.S. Supreme Court. I think it was back in 2004 out of Illinois. It was called Illinois versus Lidster. Not to get too doctrinal here, but the bottom line is the cops can set up roadblocks and almost like brief checkpoints just for purposes of handing the public a flyer to look for leads and tips to help solve a crime. And in the Lidster case, what happened was a woman, I believe, had been killed in a hit and run type traffic collision in Illinois, and it went unsolved. They were doing whatever they could to get tips. And of course, Mr. Lidster pulls up in his car. He rolls down the window and the cops say, you know, we're only looking for leads regarding who could have killed this woman. And he says, "Woo, sir, have you been drinking? I smell alcohol on your breath." The next thing he knows, he's ordered out of the car and he's arrested for DUI. And so the issue for the court was it a Fourth Amendment violation to force somebody to stand and or sit still at a roadblock or a checkpoint to help find tips and leads on a perpetrator of someone who killed a motorist or a pedestrian? And the court upheld it. The court said it was reasonable. It was constitutional. So in this case, what would be the harm? At a minimum, what would be the harm for law enforcement maybe to set up checkpoints, roadblocks, and maybe stop every other car or every fifth car, hand out a flyer with the face of Nancy, maybe hand out a flyer with the face of Porch Guy? You never know. It might generate a lead. And it could just be that sort of benevolent act that could help bring some type of closure to this investigation and bring the perpetrator to justice. But to sit idle and just let law enforcement do its job, I don't know if they necessarily will. It might not have dawned on them to do this. So hopefully somebody will get hip to this tip, go out there and maybe set up a roadblock, talk to people, see if they know somebody who knew Nancy, see if they knew somebody who used to work on her grounds, on the premises. But to not do anything is, I think, leaving us too far away from solving her disappearance.
You know what? And I know that we had talked about this off air and I sent you that. I'm so glad you remembered it because I left it off. And I'm so glad you did that research because I have been singing from the rooftops about these billboards and about these posters and putting it in Spanish and English and taking the 25 or six billboards that they have up all over the place with Nancy. It's not Nancy that needs to be up there. It's Porch Guy. It's Porch Guy. Somebody needs to find him. So this is so interesting to me, what you just said, because I did not know you could do that. You could be that invasive, and you can. And I tell you, the fact that they don't do that, and they know well about this, by the way. I mean, I've called the people. I've done everything I can do. Nevertheless, it's mind-boggling to me that nothing is done in this regard. And there's only been one. The only thing I can think of is they know who he is. That's the only reason not to have a billboard and poster and flyer campaign. That there's no other reason. So if that's the case, why aren't they getting him off the streets? We could argue, well, they might not have the evidence, but Philip, look at what they did with the other people. They detained them on nothing, on the reasonable suspicion, which is all they needed, right? Remember those first two characters? and then they let him go. So I think if they really had a bead on who he is, unless he's in Mexico, I think we would have seen him snatched up for whatever, just like what they did with Brian Laundrie, right? He used her credit card. They would have charged something to be able to detain. So,
well, what's heartening is this is one of the reasons why the statute of limitations for murder is unlimited. You never know how long it could take to crack a murder. So if you think about it, criminally and legally, there is no rush. Let the police do their job behind the scenes in silence. You and I both know that they know more than they're letting on, okay? They obviously have some type of intel that they are not sharing with the public because they don't want to compromise this investigation. It's like I said earlier, the more you come forward with, the more paranoid the perpetrators could become. And before you know it, they could think that maybe somebody they know spilled the beans, and it could put third parties in danger. The last thing you need is for a paranoid, sort of uncharged perpetrator to think that somebody has squealed and dimed him out to then get killed because of leaks that were made to the press. It's dangerous. Not to mention, it could make people kind of hide out, kind of go under, and evade capture. So for now, let them do their job in silence. We don't have to worry about the clock of the statute of limitations clicking away, because it is unbridled, unfettered, and it will linger like an evergreen.
Philip, one last thing. I am so sorry to do this to you. I promise this is my last question for you. So I came out pretty hot on this a couple of days ago, but I want to get a lawyer's vantage.
Okay.
Eric Colella, who was arrested very shortly after this case began because he sent text messages to Annie and to Tommaso that were saying he basically had Nancy. They were ransom demands for Bitcoin. He texted them. And then also, I believe, called one. They have not identified who he called, but there was a 9-second call. Okay. So basically, they plea him down to harassment. He also did methamphetamine while he was out on bond. So basically, they entered into a plea agreement agreeing to 5 years probation. 2 years was the max in this for federally for this harassment charge. They pled him down to 5 years probation, and he has to go to rehab, and he's going to be sentenced in September. So as long as he keeps his nose clean, goes to rehab. But this is the big point of contention. And I tried to explain this, and I see Lazy Days is in here. And I want to explain this because you might not have been here. But essentially, there is what I believe to be boilerplate language on the plea agreement talking about supplements. That if there is a supplement, it's maintained, but it is going to be under seal. And what I tried to explain is, federally, this is boilerplate. We put it on everyone's plea agreement, because if you only put it on the ones that are cooperating, everybody's going to know, you get in PACER and you see it, that they're cooperating. So the importance of having these plea agreements with this boilerplate, so you don't let on to who's cooperating and who is not, is totally normal. And Colella is not... Colella is a mope meth head who wanted to make a quick buck. Yes. That's my take. I want to get yours.
No, I agree with you. And if we're honest, I'm not trying to condone what he did. It was not a crime of violence. It's really a crime of opportunity and a crime of words. It's almost like a form of bribery, but the bribe was not to harm anybody. It was to divulge whereabouts or, you know, some intel about Nancy. And in exchange, he wanted money. So the real question is it extortion? Is it bribery? And if it is, what's it worth? I can tell you in California, if it was drug fueled, somebody would get diversion and a program and some help. And frankly, I don't know the Guthrie family, but I think if they really stood back and listened to his pathetic circumstances from afar, I actually think they would have sympathy for this man. And they might actually think that Nancy would not want him to go away hard for this and would want him to get some help. And hopefully it's a life lesson learned for him. He'll never do it again and he'll get the help that he needs. But make no mistake about it, he's a convicted felon now because of it. And for a lot of people who haven't done hard time, I say it all the time, Jennifer, being branded a felon sometimes is punishment enough. You have to go through life when you've led an otherwise blameless life, hiding the fact that you're a felon. And sometimes it's just terrible. It's hard to live with. And I could see how it could drive you to drink. I could see how it might actually cause him to relapse, especially if he can't find work after being a convicted felon. Now, having said that, he will be punished in accordance with the law, and it is a permissible form of punishment. And while he's on probation, if he falls off in any way or he violates the terms, make no mistake about it, he will go to prison. He's just got an opportunity to get clean, straighten out his act, and stay out of prison. But the court, if you really think about it, has this sort of carrot. It's sort of like the carrot and the stick type phenomenon dangling over him. And it's on him to walk the straight and narrow until probation is terminated. He got a break.
And this, I won't say it because I'm going to ask you the question. These plea deals, how often do they go on? Oh. You have a crime that is not a crime of violence.
Oh, all the time.
All the time.
Most drug cases, they're probably the majority of the filings in court, in criminal court, are nonviolent. They're really about self-harm. Sometimes there's an argument to be made that it is harmful to others, especially if you're a dealer and you're selling to people, especially underage people. You know, they can be labeled the war on drugs. They are the ones who are, in fact, fueling the whole drug problem. And they should be taken off the street for a while. But then, particularly in the public defender world, you get that guy who's selling one rock of cocaine just to maintain his own habit. He's not doing it so he can buy a palace in the south of France, or so he can go to Dubai and live with the glitterati there, if you will. It's just to stay high. And in the end, it's really a pathetic existence of somebody who needs help. That's all it is. It is the majority of the cases here. Most of them are nonviolent.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. And believe me, I didn't agree with this at all. Although I see your point of view, I didn't agree with it at all because of the precedent it sets for all of these sick sadists that are still trying to extort the Guthries about this case. Yes. And, you know, even if they're caught, the precedent is set and it is what it is. And I just hate that these families have to suffer with all these individuals who call up with these. But to your point, you made a great point as to why. They're nonviolent. And in Colella's case, he did have a fraud conviction, but again, it's fraud. You know, or and actually, I don't even know if it was a conviction, whether they got a conviction of it. The reason that a lot of, in this case, we have a lot of conspiracy theorists that are still going after the family, and they want so desperately for this to be something, for him to be, hold the golden charm that links Tommaso. There is absolutely not one iota proof that they know each other.
Right. So,
in fact, Cioni said, Colella said, I don't even know this family. So, you know, he saw him on TV and he said, oh, this is my opportunity. But nevertheless, you know, it is what it is in the conspiracy world. You have been amazing. Everyone loves you on my channel. You are so intelligent and such a wealth of knowledge. And thank you so much for coming on. I so appreciate it, Philip.
Oh, I appreciate the high praise. Thank you. Love the adulation.
All right. Until next time, my friend.
Be well, everybody.
Oh, you guys, I just love Philip. He's great. He's always so wonderful to have on. Such a great legal mind. And you know, there's just some people that you just have good karma with, right? Even though we are a little bit at opposite ends of the spectrum from the standpoint of he defended and I worked with the prosecution team. But we always, we've had different disagreements, even on this, right? He really understands why a probation deal. But then, you know, he understood my point of view too. And I understand both points of view. We would be all clogged up if every person who made these missing, who focus on the families of the missing and try to extort them and pretend to have their kids and all these horrible things that they do. You just don't see anybody get any time. And if you do, it's very little time. So I was not at all surprised, knew there would be a plea deal, unfortunately, just from experience with a white collar crime case where there was no real victim and no crime of violence, so to speak. But I can't thank y'all enough for being here. I really appreciate it. Even lazy days, I appreciate your point of view. It keeps us all thinking and it keeps us all looking. If you have a picture of them together, I would love to see it, of Kalela and Chione. Let me keep us in the loop on that. I'm always interested in facts. So everyone, thank you again so very much. Thank you to the mods. You all are absolutely amazing. The best in the business. I think we had several mods in tonight. I appreciate y'all so much. Thank each and every one of you for all you do, because you're the best in the business. All right, everyone. Until next time, may justice be served for Nancy Guthrie and for the families of all the missing.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Modo Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Modo Casino, the only app worth your time.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.